You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jamie and Jason. Today we're doing episode 210, and we are looking at some of the most common objections that we have heard from agnostics and atheists mostly, but really any student on campus, college campus primarily, to Christianity. So we're looking at some of those not necessarily always zingers, but sometimes I call them zingers because they're meant to be, you know, a defeater question, like, you know, can God lift a rock so heavy, you know, or can God create a rock so big that he can't lift it? That those kind of questions. Some of them are like that, but others I would say are a little bit more thoughtful. But nonetheless, I don't think that any of them are truly defeater arguments against God's existence and Christianity. But we're going to look at these. I think this is kind of a something that should be on our mind because, you know, as we reach out to our community and our young people, who a lot of these objections are coming from, we want to be thoughtful in our responses. I think it's so good that we give people the respect and honor. They're made in God's image, and so it's good to show them respect and treat them as dignity, treat them as image bearers that they are. And as we do that, we're then loving them and we're giving them space to consider Christian claims, whereas if we, you know, dumped a truckload of truth onto them, as I like to say it, without any love, then they probably won't want to hear it. So we want to talk about that, you know, the way we reach out to these folks, but also we do want to think about what are some substantive responses to some of these objections that young people are having on college campuses primarily. And Jamie, as you know, when I've gone on college campuses, and I do this with my cousin and friends, a lot of times to get to the heart of people's objections to the faith, you need to listen. You need to be really good at listening. And bringing up God, a lot of people are actually open to talk about God and religion. And I want to start off by saying we shouldn't shy away from talking with someone who maybe a young person who comes across a little bit arrogant and almost with a superior attitude. Don't be intimidated by that. A lot of times that's kind of a cover for the fact that something's been troubling them, actually. And maybe they've been struggling with faith questions for a while. I've even talked to some people who at the very beginning of the conversation where they were coming across as this bold atheist. And by the end of a conversation, no joke, 10, 15 minutes later, they admit, okay, well, I guess I mostly believe in God. I just have all these issues that I still struggle with. And so I think it's good to keep that in mind so that we're not necessarily thinking, okay, I've got to debate these people and, you know, show them Christianity wins and drop the mic and walk away. That's not how we engage with our lost neighbors around us. And so here's one I wanted to kick us off with, Jamie, because unfortunately, I say unfortunately because I really don't think it's a good objection, but here it is. If everything needs a cause for its existence, what caused God? Okay, and so basically what this is it's supposed to be, I would say it's supposed to be a response to what's called the first cause argument, or sometimes it's called something like the cosmological argument, which basically argues that everything has to have an explanation. And when we look at the universe, everything in our universe is contingent. In other words, it is dependent on something else. And so when we look at, for instance, the oak tree in your backyard, well, that came from an acorn. Well, where did that come from? That came from another oak tree. You go back ad infinitum, you have to get to what's called the first cause. You can't go into infinite regression. You have to say there is something that is uncaused that brought everything else into being and actually continues to sustain it in being. And the Bible makes this clear that not only is Christ the creator, but in him all things hold together. Colossians 1. That means that at this very moment, the entire universe, every aspect of the universe, is contingent. It's dependent on his sustaining power. And so we'd have to look at this in more depth at another time, but basically that's the argument. And so the objection is saying, okay, if everything needs an explanation, everything needs a cause, what caused God? You say the universe was caused by God. Well, what caused God? And here's where I would say there's a category mistake happening, and this is just where you want to walk them through it and say, so with everything else, there's this contingency. It's dependent on something else. But when we talk about God, the very meaning of God in the Christian sense, in a Christian worldview, God is eternal. He is immaterial. That means he's not part of this physical, material world. He's eternal, so he's timeless. He's not bound to time like everything in the universe. And he is self-existent. And so he himself is his own explanation. That's what we mean when we talk about God. And so to say what caused God is really what you're saying is what caused the being that cannot be caused. And so you see it's a contradiction when you really look at what the meaning of God is in our language. It's like asking, how long has that bachelor been married? It's a nonsensical question because by definition, a bachelor is not married. And by definition, God is he's not just a being. He is the ground of all being. He is being itself, ultimate being. And everything else depends on him and his creative power for its existence every moment of every day. And so I think helping people understand that, because there are caricatures of what we mean by God out there. And Jamie, I know you've heard these where, you know, it's almost like people have this thought of God as like, he's kind of like Zeus. He may be bigger than us, and he's like maybe got a big beard and he's really powerful, but he's basically just a bigger version of us, and he's out there somewhere. You know, like Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut, I should say, when he went into space, he was the first man in space. He said, you know, people asked him, did you see God? And he said, I didn't see him up there, you know? And so what their conception of God is apparently is that he is one more being that needs explanation. This kind of filters into another objection, but I was going to give you a chance to interact with that as well, Jamie.
Yeah, so I just wanted to comment real quick on your point in the beginning that even people that seem closed are not necessarily closed. And I want to add one more thing to that to say that a lot of people that, you know, come from a background of secularism in whatever form, they also may not have had a lot of encounters with actual Christians as well. So what they see of us is what's charactered on TV and in TV shows and, you know, that kind of thing, which doesn't represent actual Christianity at all or any Christians you actually meet in real life. And so they come in, you know, more hostile at first, in some cases, before they actually realize like, oh, hey, we're just people like them. We're not these ogres that were made out to be, you know, in popular cinema and that kind of thing, TV shows and whatnot. So that's part of that. So keep in mind, some of that hostility is just from a false perspective. And it's fair to say we can have the same perspective on the other side. You know, like I think Christians typically characterize all atheists or all agnostic people as like angry. And yet I've met many that are not like that. So certainly there are a lot that are like that, but there's also a lot that are not like that too. So just wanted to throw that in. But yeah, Jason, there's actually an arrogance in that argument as well to assume that I can understand God at all. And that's one of the craziest things we have to wrap our minds around, is that while the general revelation of God is evident, right, in creation and that kind of thing, Psalms 19 is an example of that, and God creates, and that creation showcases God's glory, right? His creative work, his divinity, the fact that there is a creator, you know, and other aspects about the nature and character of God. But you do have to settle with the fact that what we know of God is what God has revealed to us. It's not that we're so smart and we've just gone and figured these things out. It's God literally had to reveal to us. Otherwise, we would know virtually nothing about him. And so there is an ontological transcendence, right, of nature above, about the character of God that we don't understand. And we have to accept that tension of like, God is actually much bigger than our ability to grasp and comprehend him. But at the other side, it's actually illogical to say that all things have to find their origin in a cause while you're holding to evolution, which is causeless in its, you know, in its original conception. Because once you get back to the very beginning, so back to the Big Bang, when the absence of time, space, and matter collided with the absence of time, space, and matter and created all time, space, and matter, that's a real problem, right? So you're saying, wait a minute, you're saying God has to have a cause, and yet you believe in a philosophy in which creation came about causelessly. And then, of course, from there, everything has a cause. But you have to deal with that aspect of the belief, which is, well, you actually don't have a problem with causelessness because you believe in it, in the sense that at least one time in the universe, there was the absence of time, space, and matter colliding with the absence of time, space, and matter and created all time, space, and matter. Even though we all know that for anything, you have to have time, space, and matter. It's vital, right? There is no creation apart from that. If we are able to create a vacuum in which time, space, and matter doesn't exist, guess what? We don't see a replication of the Big Bang. It doesn't happen. There isn't any. Because without those three elements, you cannot have anything that, you know, is. And so really, it is kind of a nonsensical argument, Jason, in that sense as well, that you actually are exposing yourself to the very hypocrisy that you claim that we're saying, in the sense that we believe God just was and just is, and certainly he was, right? The biblical narrative of creation is in the beginning God. So where was God? Well, before the beginning, he already was. He just was. And we see other shades of that as well. Like in John chapter 17, verse 24, it says, Jesus says that, you know, God the Father was loving the Son before the creation of the world. Meaning, before creation came about, God already was. Again, same point. And you have a creation narrative in which you have time, space, and matter, right? In the beginning, that's time. God created the heavens, that's space, and the earth, that's matter. So you got time, space, and matter, the full, all the elements needed for creation. So is it easier then to believe God who was? And to your point, Jason, it's a great, great thing to remind them. Yeah, you're not using comparable realities here, right? Creation is separate from who God is. He's not part of creation. He's outside and above that. And yet, that narrative speaks to not only how God was, but also how creation came about as a result of that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's so important, because I think that one of the new atheists, one of their favorite things to say was, look, do you believe in Thor? Do you believe in Zeus? And of course, the Christian always would say, no, no, of course not. And they'd say, well, we just believe in one less God than you. And it was supposed to be like this, you know, amazing, stunning statement. But again, the problem with that is all those gods of the pagans, none of them were at all like God, in the sense that God is morally perfect. God is not part of his creation in the sense that these Greek gods were part of their creation. They, or in other words, they were part of the world. They were all limited. In fact, if you read through those pagan mythologies, they're always like the gods are kind of bumbling. They make a lot of mistakes. They're ignorant of certain things that humans are doing, and they're surprised. And that's not at all like God. And again, God, as we're talking about in Christian theology, he is the ground for all being. He's the foundation for everything. None of those pagan deities were like that. And so that just kind of, it's a good reminder that we're not, it's not, it's not even a close comparison to say Yahweh is just one of the many gods that have been believed in. No, that's why the Jews were so weird, and I mean that in a good sense. They were so different from the rest of the ancient world. They believed, they were monotheists. They believed there is only one God who created it all, and everybody else had these tribal deities that they were basically being sponsored by. Another common objection that I will very often hear is, look, I'm scientifically minded. I prefer to look to science for answers rather than look to a God to explain things. And usually when I hear that one, I want to like affirm what I can. I don't want to like go right to here's everything wrong about that statement. I want to say, look, it's wrong to assume God did it in a simplified sense. Like anytime you can't explain certain things, like lightning, they would attribute to the gods, right? And we would agree, like, yeah, scientific explanations, they don't, you know, if we can't figure out the first, you know, first little bit of it, then we're just going to throw up our hands and say, oh, God must be just doing that. It's like, yeah, that's different from how Christians would go about it. But the thing that I think is helpful is to first ask them the question in return, do you know how modern science first took off? Like, do you know why it's around and why it's been so successful? Like, who got it started? And most often, a lot of times at least, they will not be aware that almost all of the fathers of modern science, so those original scientists in the sense that we were talking about of scientists today who use the scientific method, almost all of them were theists, and most of them were even Christians. And that's not an overstatement. This is something that's just, it's just historical fact. If you look into it, Francis Bacon, Galileo, Copernicus, Kepler, I mean, I could go on and on. Michael Faraday, these guys were Christian believers. They subscribed to the Bible. They held the Bible to be the inspired word of God. And, you know, the whole reason why Galileo is known for that statement of there's the book of nature and the book of scripture is he believed both are sources of revelation. One special revelation, that's scripture, and the other is general revelation, that's nature. And he said they're not in conflict. They're not opposed to each other. And the whole problem that he had with the Catholic Church at the time was it wasn't really about science per se. It was much more of a political thing that was going on. If you look into the history, he had offended the Pope, and there was all these little political rivalries and intricacies that went into that story. So it wasn't strictly Galileo on the side of science versus the church or anything like that. Not at all. The other thing I'd want to point out is it sounds like what you're saying is science explains everything, but I would want to push back on that and say when you are very passionate about moral things, like for instance, when you talk to me about the importance of being aware of climate change and things like that, you know, and I would say, look, I think it's good to be a good steward of the environment. God created it; He made us His image bearers to rule over His created world, so we are to be good stewards. So a lot of these things, you know, you try to meet them halfway, but when they say, look, it's a terrible thing. It's wrong that people are you know, causing all this excess pollutants, all these gases being released into the atmosphere. This is all wrong, and it's causing climate change. So I would want to ask them, scientifically, can you explain to me why it's wrong? I'm not asking you to explain what's happening scientifically. It's not a what question, but why? Why is, from a purely scientific language, explain it just in science, why is it wrong? And then, you know, they could start to use moral language. They'll say, well, look, this is going to cause devastation for future generations. It's going to wipe out some of the endangered species. Okay. Big whoop. I mean, you can scientifically explain that will happen. You know, you can use scientific terminology, but why is that such a big deal? Why are you so passionate about it if science can tell you everything? And I think what you get at, if you're, again, be gentle, but what you're wanting to push them to see is that you can't explain everything scientifically. You can't explain why something is wrong scientifically. I mean, a great example is the idea of, you know, poisoning a neighbor, right? You know, if you give someone with tea or someone a cup of tea with strychnine in it, John Lennox uses this example, you can scientifically explain why the strychnine in the tea is going to kill your neighbor, right? And but scientifically, you can't explain why it's wrong to give that strychnine to your neighbor. You can explain what it is, what's going to cause that death. You can't explain why that'd be wrong. And that's where this worldview, and it's called scientism, which basically says all relevant knowledge can be determined by empirical science. That's scientism. Science has the answers for all that we need. The big problem there is you can't answer questions like, why would artificial intelligence wiping out the human race be wrong? You can't explain that. You can't do it in scientific terms. You can't explain why it'd be wrong. You can't do any moral questions. You can't even really talk about things like logic, for example. Logic is just a given. We know intuitively logic makes sense, or mathematics, same thing. But you can't explain scientifically why mathematics works. It just does. It's part of the structure of the universe. It's 2 + 2 is always going to be 4. That's how this world is. That's mathematics. It's a basic intuition. But you can't explain that scientifically. And that's where it breaks down, is people have looked at all the technology and the great scientific advancements in medicine and all kinds of things. And so they then have this inflated view of science as if science is then the know-all, be-all, and end-all, and that all knowledge that's important will come from science. And the simple fact is, you know, you can explain things with physics about a bomb going off. You can't say why someone should or should not drop that bomb, though. And that's a big problem. That's a big limitation for science.
Yeah, I think another good example of this is when it comes to the issue of abortion. And the question of what is life? What constitutes life? So there are sort of scientific answers to that question, right? We know that if your brain is not active and your heart is not beating, then you are not alive, right? That's pretty straightforward. But what is life? It's an abstract reality separate from science. And there really isn't actually a science explanation for it. Or the soul is another example of this. What is the soul? So we can talk about quality of life issues, right? This person that, let's say, lives on a ventilator, okay, they have a quality of life issue, but you wouldn't say they're not alive, right? They still have this soul, and it's connected to their body, even though we can't scientifically show that, right? There's no x-ray for the soul. There's no way to test for the soul. You can't draw blood and run back and find the soul particles, right? That's not a thing. And yet, if you've ever seen somebody dead, which most of us have, not in a weird way, I'm talking about like grandparents and stuff like that, but when you see somebody die, especially, there's a dramatic difference. So I was in the room when one of my grandpas died, and I can very much tell you that there was a difference. I don't know what the difference was, but there was, and then there was not. There was a human, and then there was not life. And there's something dramatically different there. And yet, scientifically, what happened? Well, their brain stopped and their heart stopped. But that's not the X factor. The X factor is that soul that was there is no longer there, right? So we see this in a lot of things. To just further bolster your point, science cannot answer all these things. And then, of course, I always like to ask the question, what about though when science has been wrong? If our objective reality is built on a subjective thing that is ever changing, then how do we have any actual knowledge at all, really? And you can go from there into even the question, well, what about when the Bible has been right and science has been wrong? Because that's a real question as well. I mean, think of in Leviticus 17, the Bible talks about how the life is in the blood. Well, we bled people for 300 years thinking that was the way to get disease out, which of course we now know is not the way to get disease out. In fact, they need that blood because that blood becomes the vehicle by which your immune system, your T cells, and those virus attacking cells of the body are able to move around the body and attack, you know, these viruses. And so removing that actually hinders the ability of somebody to survive, to fight off, you know, illness. And there's been lots of examples like that as well. But at the end of it though, Jason, you really are left with the profound reality that science actually doesn't prove anything, that it can't. It's deficient in its ability. And if I'm looking to science to resolve every question, I'm going to end up very disappointed because there are some questions we still haven't figured out, even with all the science we got. What is gravity is another example of that, right? We know what gravity does, and this confuses a lot of people because we think, oh, we know what gravity is. No, we don't. We know what gravity does. We know what the effect is, but we don't know what is the cause. What makes this gravitational pull happen? Is it, you know, is it a black hole in the universe? We don't know. We literally don't know. And so science really actually doesn't get there. And science also doesn't explain any of the why. Why do we exist? What is our purpose, right? These are questions greater than science itself. If I'm solely reliant on science as the only source of truth, then I have to actually conclude, and many do, that life actually has no purpose, that there actually is no reason for existence. But then you got to answer the question, what though happens when you remove purpose from people? Well, they get depressed. Why? If there really isn't anything there, then the removal of any purpose shouldn't cause any issues, right? Animals, by and large, have no purpose, and they're not bothered by that. You don't see them depressed. There's no, you know, you don't see beavers out there just laying on the side of the banks, refusing to build dams because what's the point, right? That's not a thing. I mean, I'm being a little silly there, but it is, I think it's a fair question to say, but why is it that when you take away purpose from people, they either get depressed or they die? One or the other. Take away purpose. And again, the Bible speaks to this reality that without a purpose, people perish. That is a fact. And why? Because we were designed by a God who had great purpose for us, for our lives, and for God's eternal glory.
Yeah, and I think it's just, that's a great point, Jamie. And I think, like, speaking to that existential question of meaning and purpose is so important. And even if they don't bring up the subject, I think it's good for the Christian to do that, because we have every reason to talk about purpose and meaning and value. All these things that really have no place in an atheistic framework. And we just want to gently push in on that. You know, the point isn't to say, as an atheist, there's no point to your life. The point is to say, given what you're believing, it doesn't seem like there could be any objective purpose for anybody's life. If it all ends in nothingness, man, what are we doing here? But if there is a God who made us for a relationship with him, and for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life, we got to know about this God, because that means that life has purpose, life has meaning and value. And you certainly, as the atheist or the agnostic, whoever it may be, you certainly need to know this God. And obviously, a lot of times they'll say, like, okay, well, I develop my own purposes. I come up with my own reasons for living. And what we're getting at is, look, I believe you, you know, whatever that might be, but we're talking about objective purpose for your life, that for your existence as a human being. This is what we're talking about. So I think we only have time for one more, because we're running out of time, right? But the other big one I hear from a lot of people is, I don't need God to be moral. I just know, and this is what you most often will hear, I just know I don't want to bring harm to anyone, and so I don't need God to know that. And here's where I would start again with a question. I think this is a good way to go. Ask them, do you think there's been a time in history where people were morally wrong about something? And if they're like, well, I don't know. Okay, how about the Nazis? Were they morally wrong when they wanted to exterminate the Jews? Than when they did the Holocaust? And I obviously, there were a huge number of Germans. It certainly wasn't all Germans, but as a society, this was approved of. As a society, this was the direction they were going. And so they can't really appeal to whatever societal norm is the standard for morality, because in that case, we don't want that. Or you could even go back to the 1800s and say, look, were there some people in the South who were morally wrong about owning slaves? And of course, it's in a way, it's a trap, but I'd say it's a good kind of trap. You're wanting them to see reality. Moral truths are objective, and they exist in the world because they come from God. Only God could be the foundation for objective moral values. And so by pushing them to see, they were wrong to own slaves. But that's because they caused harm. It's not because they needed God to tell them that. Well, then you can push back and say, now hang on a second, because if civil rights have improved since the Civil War, and usually they would agree to that. Sometimes people wouldn't, but hopefully they would. And the opportunities for Black Americans has improved. In other words, it's better to be a Black person in America today than it was to live in a slave state in 1860. And hopefully they can just, yes, okay, affirm that. If it's better, well, whenever we talk about something being better, we're appealing to a standard. Because anytime you say, like, I know that, LeBron James is really good at basketball and Michael Jordan was really good at basketball, but I think Michael Jordan was better. Well, what you're saying is he's better at something, and there's got to be standards. You look at stats and things like that. And so for this case, you are, whether you realize it or not, when you say something is morally better, help them to see you're actually acknowledging there's a standard, and that right now, being a Black American today is closer to that standard of goodness or rightness or whatever you might want to put it, like treated fairly than in 1860 in a slave state. And so if that is the case, then that means that there has to be something above that transcends our human society, because it's our human society that's being judged. It's our human society that's being measured. And so you have to appeal to something transcendent above that society as the standard. And that standard has to be objective. And that the only possible answer is God. I mean, if you just help walk them through that, you have to see only God can be that standard, because only God transcends this world, and only He is perfect goodness. And you know, the scriptures say He is righteousness. His throne, He's enthroned in righteousness, and He is purely good. There's no sense in which God needs to try to be good or is trying to measure up to a perfect standard. He is the perfect standard. He is the good that Plato talked about. And I think helping people recognize, that's called the argument of degrees, Aquinas used. You know, if there's something better, if you recognize that something is clearly objectively better, then you are appealing to a standard that transcends those two situations.
Yeah, it's a good point. And to further piggyback on that point, even recognizing that there are universal realities is an aspect of that. Where do those come from? You know, how is it that in every society, in every country, in every part of the world, in every different, you know, you're dealing with different cultures and different languages and different histories and different philosophies and theologies and even origin stories, and yet there are these what we call universal laws that are apparent in every cultural context in every part of the world. And you go, how is that possible? You think that, well, not every society is going to hold the same standards for various things, right? And we see that in large part. And yet at the same time, there are some of these realities that seem to transcend culture and society and part of the world and history and all these sorts of things. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from God. But the bigger thing is, apart from God, then objectively, how can you have good and bad, right? Because to frame good and bad, you have to have some standard by which you look at that. You go, well, that was evil that they did. Well, but they didn't think it was evil. So how can you call it evil? By your standard, if it's subjective, right? My standard, your standard, her standard, then we actually have no basis upon which we can determine any value. And at the end of the day, why is murder bad? Because people have value. But why do people have value? Because God decreed it so, right? We would say, more so than that, man is made in the image of God, therefore man has value. But take that away, well, we just came about by accident. Then does it really matter if somebody murders somebody else? Not really, because there really isn't actual, you know. And so this idea that I can be the determiner of good and bad is problematic as well, because that's built around what I believe is good and bad, not what objectively is good and bad. So there is a need for a universal law, something that is above us, something that is greater than my own thinking, that never changes, that even as I change and as society changes and as culture changes and all these things change, that thing doesn't change. And that's the basis upon which, you know, good and bad is ultimately determined. Because I would bet you, the vast majority of people you ask, is it okay to murder? They'd say no. But guess what? There are some people that think it's okay because they do it. So obviously they think it's okay. And if it isn't for some law greater than my thinking, then they actually prevail in the end, because who are we at the end of the day to tell them they're wrong?
So, Jamie, I think what we've done is we've just given a sampling, but these are some of the big ones that you're going to encounter, especially from young people today. And again, I want to reemphasize the need to love them. Love them. Show them Christ when you are interacting with them. I mentioned asking questions a lot, because that's kind of, for me, that's gotten the most headway with a lot of folks, because, you know, there's a lot of caricatures where religious people, all they do is they make pronouncements and they make judgments about me and my behavior. Asking questions is a way to invite them into the conversation, invite them to think through what they're claiming. And I say what they're claiming because a lot of times they don't really believe what they're saying, not deep down. They may have heard this from some really smart atheists, and they think it's a good thing to say. I'm guessing that so many of these claims, they haven't really thought through. And so by asking a question, you're in a very non-attacking way, you're giving them a way to think through the implications of what they've just claimed. And I think that's a Christ-like, gentle way to respond to those who are lost. Because ultimately what matters, and this is what we want our listeners to hear, ultimately what matters is that we are reconciled to God. That's the hope. And when we are interacting with these folks, we are being ambassadors for Christ. And that's what we care about, is that they be reconciled to God. Because right now they're under his wrath, they're under his judgment, and we don't want them to stay there. We want them to be saved and delivered by the grace of God, by trusting in Jesus and his blood on the cross. So that's our encouragement for you, and we want to just encourage you to be willing to speak to these young folks, even if they're exuding a lot of confidence, be willing to show them Christ.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.